And we're back. This is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. And our guest is Ann Charney, and she's an award-winning novelist, short story writer, and journalist. Her work has been published in many languages and in many countries. Ann Charney's books include Life Class, Rousseau's Garden, Distantly Related to Freud, and Defiance in Their Eyes. And she was made an officer of the Order of Letters of France. Ann Charney, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
I look forward to talking to you because this book, Dobrid, I think I'm on my third reading of it, and I do tell everybody listening, please do read Dobrid. Read it three times. Actually, any good book, please read it a couple of three times. It has, by the way, an excellent foreword by Peter MacFarlane, author of Family Ties. This book, I have to start. It must have been difficult to write. It must be a very special kind of thing. This is a story of a little girl and her mother and her aunt who find themselves in a zone where the Germans have moved in, and word is spreading that they have a campaign to annihilate the Jews. And through some good fortune, I'm going to ask you about this, the family, this remnant, these three, find themselves in a loft, and the little girl for 2.5 years is hiding with adults in a loft, looked over by a Polish woman. And the book begins with the war between the Russians and the Germans reaching them. And the little girl hears silence, and then she hears foreign voices. And this is so poignant. Did it actually happen that someone was singing, that when the soldiers came into the barn where this girl is hiding?
Oh, that's at the end of the book, when they're finally freed by the Russian soldiers, right?
Yeah. Well, it's also at the beginning where she hears singing. And that somehow struck me. There were so many things that happened suddenly to her. She's now 5 years old, I guess. And
when she's liberated, she's five. But when she enters into hiding, she's about two and a half.
Yes. So, and the sight of her cousin says, those are Russians. And the song was recognized, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, not by the child, but by the adults, yes.
As someone who appreciates that Nazism was defeated, destroyed, these are stories, to me, I've always wanted to see, because, as you know, most Canadian Western people, they think of basically what used to call the Western Front. So the ally, the big one, called Russia, seemed to play a big role, and that remnant that survived the attempt by the Nazis scientifically to destroy an entire people, found themselves in the hands, arms of these Russians, and there were women soldiers as well as men, right?
Right.
Did you reflect on that? I mean, how many people understand that women were fighting in the Russian army?
I don't know. I have no idea what people understand or not, but I think that part of communism was to bring equality to women as well. Mm-hmm. And so in some ways things were harder for women, but in other ways they were much better because they were given opportunities which more conservative societies did not offer women. Mm-hmm. So to find women in the army, plus for Russia it was a fight to the death. You know, if you think of the siege of Stalingrad, so everybody had to participate. teenagers were soldiers in the Soviet Army, you know. So it was not such a surprise that women were in it.
Yeah, and the first figure that emerges very large in the book is, of course, the soldier named Yuri.
Yes, this is when they're liberated. This is towards the end, yeah.
He was almost like your personal liberator, because I found it extraordinary that he sort of adopted your family. He was suddenly, you know, again, once again, we move from just somebody being called a soldier and an incident. This is a living human being who, you, as you point, he had fought at Stalingrad. He actually was wearing medals when he found you.
Mm-hmm. But he was also very young, and I think far from his family, and with no contact for the most part with his family. So to find another family that he could protect gave him, a sense of comfort. So I think that was part of the reason he attached himself to this little girl and her mother and her aunt.
And it becomes, in your book, by the way, beautifully written, because it never quite says everything, but you're all very much appreciative of each other. But there, inevitably, even though you're all together against Nazism and there's political problems and tensions, but also you bring out the fact that Yuri returned to see his home village at one point after it was, the mm-hmm. Germans were just about defeated, and his village was gone, his family, and the people there. And again, I hope people hear this, that the Russian, he was a Russian. That was a Russian village, and he said they had taken, the Germans had taken, I guess it was vengeance on that village, and they made people dig their own graves.
Mm-hmm.
As a little girl hearing that, how does she hold
up? Well, you know, children have the ability to normalize everything, because if it's not presented as strange to their own world, it's not strange, you know. So if the conversation in the barn loft where they were hidden between the adults touched on events outside the barn, which were pretty awful, but it becomes part of the sort of the context in which this child is growing up, and it's not as shocking as it would be a child in a town in Canada who's suddenly presented with a story like that.
Yes.
I mean, children do have the ability to normalize.
Yes. You know, somebody said there's one thing children notice, and that's everything.
Yes.
And you were treated, it seems to me, people should know that you write in the book, your life was happy because you had adults all paying attention. They were almost turning you into a prodigy because they were teaching you math. Reading and writing.
Right. I think now that I'm an adult, I can sort of understand that the motivation was not only affection, but it was also it was essential that the child not make any noise, because there were constant German patrols who passed by the barn where they were hidden. And if they heard a child crying, it would attract attention. So everybody did their best to entertain me and to teach me ways of entertaining myself, which is one of the reasons why I see it as a very unusual and rich period in my life or the child's life, you know?
It's yes, you describe, you're the weak point in the
right.
Safety of the adults. And so they have two thoughts about you. They weren't exactly anxious for you to join them, were they?
No.
Can you talk about that? Why?
Well, as I just explained, a child made them all vulnerable. They were hidden. They could not be seen or heard by the villagers where the barn was, nor by the German patrols, because there was a prize that the villagers could earn if they told the Germans that there were people hidden in the barn. So it was very dangerous to have someone who couldn't understand how necessary it was to be quiet and hidden.
And finally, you got to scream because you were saved.
Sunset.
Yes. Now, you've written about a woman. Her name is Manya.
Mm-hmm.
And years after you've been in that barn, you are, as a Pole, because you were Polish, you spoke Polish, mm-hmm. your family decided to leave your hometown because, frankly, I guess who could face the fact that the town, which had been majority Jewish population, had been wiped out. The homes.
Go ahead. The reason they left was not because of that. They left because the part where they came from was annexed to Russia. It was a sort of, you know, Scrabble game after the war. So the Soviets, as the winners, took part of Poland, which also included Ukraine, and attached it to the Soviet Union. Mm. And those citizens who wanted to remain Polish were expatriated to the new territories that the Soviets had annexed from Germany.
Yes.
So we were shipped from the part where my family came from to the new German territories, and I actually grew up in a town called Breslau, which in before the war was called Breslau. So it was a very, it was a shifting scene all the time.
Borders and languages. It was
borders, languages, and ethnic identities.
You have a great. Go ahead.
The woman who looked after us, Manya, spoke Polish as well as my family, but she was actually of Ukrainian origin, and she remained in the part that became Ukraine and became annexed to the Soviet Union.
Yes. Now, I have to just put it this way. She's an angel of a sort, but she's also not an angel at all. And I want to... She comes to find your mother and your aunt and after the war, and she embraces you, and which you don't mind because you remember her, but then you notice that your mother and your aunt are not too happy to see her. Talk about what was going on there.
Well, you know, without passing any judgment, because people were living in extreme conditions, she was doing it for the money. The people whom she hid paid her. And as long as they kept paying her, she brought them food at night and protected them in a way. I mean, I don't think it was an altruistic motive, but a survival motive for her as well as for them. And so towards the end, when their money ran out and they could hear the approaching front from the Soviets getting closer, she stopped bringing money because they no longer had any. And so there were stories that I was told that they had to remove like wedding rings or whatever jewelry they had just to make sure that they didn't starve to death on the eve of liberty.
Yeah, what I found quite touching and beautifully done in your book is that after pointing out the ugliness of the situation, the fact that she was doing it for money, and as a matter of fact, she had even anticipated what was going to happen when the Germans arrived. So she made a list of people that she thought would give her money if she hid them.
Right.
But even in there is a little quirk because she liked your grandfather.
Right.
And she offered him.
Worked for him, yes.
Just because he had been kind to her once.
Yes, exactly.
Now, here's where I congratulate you, and I really urge people to read the book. You actually give her what I guess in Hollywood they call a backstory. It must have been told to you by your aunt, but you managed to actually describe her in such a way that a person can't help but be sympathetic. Could you talk about that?
Well, you know, I don't see her as an evil force, as an evil person. I have to see her as someone who saved the lives of some members of my family, including mine. And the fact that she was doing it for money, her conditions were pretty awful as well, pretty extreme. And she had a chance to do something to better her situation and that of her daughter. So, you know, sometimes the basest motives can lead to the greatest benefits.
Yeah. And she was a daughter of an abused person, a mocked person. Her mother was considered simple, right?
Exactly. So, you know, it never occurred to me when I was writing it to think of her as someone who was only interested in money or evil. I thought of her as someone who, because of her situation, suffered a great deal, and because of her situation, she was able to help people when the circumstances changed. The enemy came, and people needed hiding.
And, you know, the knife of fate was passed back and forth, because she finds herself asking your mother, please help me. And your mother,
yes,
mother and your aunt were very cold, but it must have begun to slowly work into their minds, and they did help her.
They did, and I think that when they finally came to Canada, they used to send her money monthly, but, you know, I that's not part of the story, so I'm not really talking
about
it. By the
way, what amazing fate for her. She was trying to get rich. You say she was going to buy a hotel where she once,
yes,
had to shine shoes.
Yes.
And
like
she was going to take
the penny opera,
and,
you know.
And the Soviets arrived, and the money and the hotel went up in smoke. And she,
well,
though
it,
she saved,
say,
that she needed them. Please go on, yeah.
No, it's just that you can't take anything for granted in the area where this story is set, because everything changed. I know, for example, that when my grandparents were born, they were citizens of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And then my mother was a citizen of Poland, independent. And it just, and then it became Ukraine. And so it was constantly shifting. And there was nothing that could be taken for granted. What belonged to you, who you were, what your identity was, what's the language you had to master. Mm-hmm. A very shifting scene.
And you became, and you, in the book, it's clear, you learned, you watched adults and listened to them and realized that you couldn't trust them either. You had to begin to become, look, you had to be yourself. But we're talking about a 5 to 10-year-old learning,
right,
some terrible, terrible truths.
I don't think that's so unusual. I think most children notice these things, that they don't, mm-hmm, they don't remember, or they don't act upon them when they're older. There are very few people who are sort of true to the self that they are when they're young, you know. But because I think that childhood was so powerful, the memories of that period lasted well into adulthood.
Mm-hmm. I'll just say lastly again on the matter of Manya. To me, it was like reading Dostoevsky, particularly your account
of wonderful
her life. No, it really is. I'm thinking, actually, there's a character in Karamazov. It's the unofficial brother who never gets talked about. I don't know why,
yes,
but Smerdyakov, which means son of the reeking woman. And she, of course, was the daughter of a reeking,
yes,
woman.
The unlucky one.
And their thought process, your character, Manya, who is, of course, a real human being, and Dostoevsky's character, Smerdyakov, they're very similar because they're born with resentment and,
right,
a dark view of people around them, and a little taste for revenge. Beautifully,
for sure.
It's beautifully written. I want to ask you, I know you're a scholar of Marcel Proust, so you went on to get...
I'm a lover of Marcel Proust. I don't know if I'm a scholar.
Well,
I wrote
that,
my
I think that him, opens, yes, the door to being a scholar. So did study of Proust help you write this book? Because you managed to be very cool in your prose when I'm feeling fury behind it. So talk about that.
Well, you know, Proust was really my Bible to life. It was the most important book I ever read, and it taught me everything I needed to know about how to proceed through life and also how to write. Mm-hmm. I enormously admired the way he told stories, not just the stories that he told. And so, yes, it had an enormous influence on me, and it still does. And I think, you know, if you're lucky enough to find a, especially if you want to be a writer, and you find a book that lasts you through several decades, it's very fortunate. And I think Proust holds up as well today as it did when I first discovered it. Don't you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, well, it's that, again, you know the word that I noticed Peter McFarlane used it? It's called distance. It's the ability,
yes,
to be looking at something which could be reported like a disaster, yet it's slowly and smoothly discussed.
Well, I think that it's much more powerful that way. I mean, I hate overwritten prose. I hate things where people seem to fill their sentences with emotion, because it doesn't allow the emotion to fill the reader, because readers have to find their own feelings to the prose, and the only way you can do it is by evoking certain things, but subtly. Mm-hmm. And that's always been my goal in writing, whether nonfiction or fiction.
Yeah.
By the way, the Globe picked the book this weekend as one of the best reads of the summer.
Yes, they call it one of the hot books, one of the 35 hot books published in Canada.
Oh, hot books, even better.
I like the word hot. I mean, that means
we're
supposed to. That means race to the bookstore to get it while it's still hot.
I mean by leaving out emotion. I would never.
Here's your second success with this book, because this was published in the 1970s and
50 years ago,
and it had impact then. It. How vibrant. You must be pleased that it just keeps marching along.
Well, I'm sort of bemused, really, particularly at this last mention in the Globe, because at the time that I was trying to get it published, the hardest time I had was in Canada. The other countries were much more interested in the story and in the writing. Mm-hmm. But Canada was the most difficult, and it's also the first place where the book has gone out of print, which is why Baraka Books republished it. You know,
yes.
It's still in print in the U.S. and France and Italy and Germany, etc.
Well,
I find it a bit more. I'm amused by the whole thing.
Yes. Well, you should be, of course, because the book is a triumph. I think I mentioned earlier when we spoke that I think your problem in Canada was that you were rescued by the wrong army.
Exactly.
I mean, because we live in the land, as you know. The Americans won the war. I think you heard about that.
Yeah. Nobody wanted a book where the hero was a young Soviet soldier. That was my biggest problem, absolutely. You had to tell the story from the point of view of the American conquerors and liberators.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, I had lived a different story.
Yeah. Well, you know, a Canadian soldier who wrote a great book, Farley Mowat, would love your book. Absolutely. He must have loved it. I hope he read it, Bennett, because it's exactly what he thought we should be reading. Can I ask you lastly here, how difficult is it to write about your own family? Is there an ache or a wonder?
I think all writing is very difficult, because you put part of yourself into everything. At least I do. I put part of myself, whether I'm writing about Mohawk warriors or terrorists or, people in France or Italy. There's always something of myself that's in it. So it's equally difficult, but there's also the distancing, you see. Like, it could be a story that's more closer to my own experience, but the process of writing removes it from that realm and puts it into words, into something that you're telling other people about. So it becomes easier in a way to do that. But so, no, all writing is equally difficult.
Yeah. So
what I find amusing, though, is because I wrote both fiction and nonfiction, people always thought that my nonfiction was made up, that it was not true, and that my fiction was autobiographical.
Well, I personally assume that you are a distant relative of Freud, since Freud's mother was from the same town.
Yes, yes. It's the beginning of an idea, anyway.
So there is, you don't have that sort of, oh, I wonder what Cousin Elroy was going to think about this.
My family was all dead. All I had was my mother and my aunt. My father had been shot when he was 30. There was nobody else left. So I didn't have that particular problem. I had other problems, but not that one. I think that most people actually like to hear their stories told. In my experience from interviewing people, I found that it always amazed me that I could come up to anybody and start asking them questions, and they would answer them. And I think people are very eager to talk about themselves.
Yeah, and isn't it possible so they want, because they want to actually orient themselves in the world? They're not sure. who they are. Exactly. They know what happened, but they're not sure who they are. And
exactly. And I think we all live on stories. You know, we all survive by stories we tell ourselves, about our lives, about our friends, and about who we are. And I think that that's what gets us through the journey.
Yeah. One last thing. Thank you for mentioning that everybody sang. Isn't it odd? You were singing in a loft while the Germans are looking for you, and the people that you associate with, everybody sang. I don't know that they do that anymore.
No, I don't know. I haven't.
Do you remember all the songs? We played the song, Give Me 5 Minutes
Yes,
More.
I heard that at the beginning before you spoke to me, yes.
Well, we're going to keep playing it. We hope we can talk to you again. It's a marvelous book. By the way, it's in the Toronto Library, and there are many holds on it. So I think people ought to go to Baraka Books, order the book, buy it, and buy several copies and give them to your friends. Anne Charney, it's a great pleasure talking to you.
And to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Taylor Report, CIUT, Steve Fruitman's coming up here pretty soon, and Pedro will tell me when to shut up. I think he just told me. All right, see you next week.